Hello and welcome to The Tidal Year, the podcast that discovers the joys of swimming. My name is Freya and joining me today is Dr. Suzanne Masters, a plant scientist and writer on all things ethnobotany. She joined me to talk about conservation, completing the Bosphorus cross-continental swim, and encounters with seals. Enjoy! Before we dive into this episode, I'd like to thank today's sponsor, TryHard. I love being in the water, but I don't love what pool chemicals like chlorine do for my skin and hair. TryHard develop water sports specialized skin and hair solutions that eliminate those negative effects of pool chemicals and ocean salts. I'm thrilled to share with all listeners of The Tidal Year a very exclusive 15% off when you use code TIDAL at tryhard.co. Thank you so much for joining me, Susan.
Hi. It's nice to meet you online, actually, after seeing your project online, but not directly talking to you.
Yeah, I always feel like I know somebody quite well as well after I've read lots by them. So I might be overly familiar just because I've read some of your writing. But Susan, so you're a plant scientist and you've studied conservation and ethnobotany. Is that how I'd say it? Can you tell me a little bit about what that is and about how you got interested in water and plants and everything conservation?
Okay, so plant scientist is a bit more how people are talking about botanist now. I don't know if some people feel like botanist is old-fashioned, but it pretty much means the same thing. Ethnobotanist means you're interested in plants, but you're also particularly interested in the ways that people interact with them. So this can be as foods, using them as materials, medicinal applications, not just traditional uses, but you know, some of my colleagues work on developing new drug treatments based on traditional knowledge, but giving it the pharmaceutical standardization that's, you know, much easier for prescribing medication and treating conditions than the sort of the different relationship you need with someone prescribing plants and, you know, knowing when to pick them at the right time and being able to scale up production. So there's all kinds of ethnobotany, and some of that is also wildlife trade. And I know it's always rhino horns and tiger skins and elephants and trophy hunting takes a lot of attention. But actually, when you talk about wildlife trade and you look at CITES, which is the international agreement, restricting wildlife trade in species that are threatened by trade, I think 83% of the species listed there are plants, in fact. So yeah, there's way more plants. And most of those species are actually orchids. There's reasons for that, including that it's quite hard to tell some orchids apart if they're not flowering, or so it's easier to put a whole group under protection than the one species. But also a lot of orchids are edible, have medicinal uses, so there's a lot of interest in their purchase and use across different countries. So my PhD research is really looking at the trade in edible orchids, a particular group of edible orchids that make ice cream chewy. And they also make this hot drink, which is a bit, it's called salep, which is a bit sort of slippery and it's very soothing if you've got a cough or a cold. So the kind of ethnobotany is quite big field and it's very interdisciplinary. And at the moment I'm housed in Naturalis Biodiversity Centre in the Netherlands. So, and the department is evolutionary ecology, and I'm working on some phylogenetics at the moment. So it's very varied what people get into. But also there's the idea that people tend to think wildlife trade happens in distant places. And that this also comes up in the book right at the start, is introducing the idea that even when you're on land, you're actually quite dependent on aquatic species. So every other breath you take comes from little tiny microscopic algae in the oceans. Yes, the rainforest in the Amazon, yes, trees, but every other breath, and you need both of those breaths. So, and then, you know, a lot of things in our food cupboards, they come, they're harvested from aquatic systems, or they use species, and their farming actually has an effect on oceans. So for example, it's quite getting more attention now with salmon farming and the impact of that. And that farmed salmon isn't necessarily a better choice in environmental terms than wild salmon. So it's really looking at the idea that even if you're in the city and you're not going out in the countryside, you're actually very connected to this wildlife and to a certain extent reliant on it as well. And it's interesting to look at those relationships and then start thinking about making informed decisions, what you do, what you pay attention to, shopping choices, and issues that might seem quite distant and separate from you, when you realize actually, oh, later on, further down the line, these things really affect me. So maybe feeling more confident in petitioning your MP or talking to people about impacts and how you can mitigate them or maybe avoid them.
Oh, thank you for such an articulate answer to a very broad question. But you must get to work with some fascinating people doing a real variety of things. And I recently spoke to Leif Bersweden, who's also a botanist, and it was great to kind of have that enthusiasm and curiosity for plants. And so, and he's actually also fascinated with orchids. So it's interesting that you mentioned that, because to me, orchids are very beautiful, delicate flowers, but I don't often think about the uses for plants or maybe the properties that they have. And so, you know, one thing I spoke about with Leif was like, as soon as you then spark that interest, if you know about something, you can then care for it. So I was really interested to hear you talk about the medicinal properties of different plants, because whenever I hear medicinal properties, it always makes me think a lot more about old-fashioned medicine or folklore or ritual. But I guess actually there's a lot of real scientific and medical uses for plants.
Right. So one of the great, you know, scientific developments in recent years was the development of artemisinin from Artemisia, so sort of wormwood species, for treatment of malaria. And we know, you know, there are various sort of prophylactics for malaria, some of which have quite dramatic side effects, like larium, and some of which have, you know, they upset your digestive system, and some of them aren't very effective. So if you travel abroad, they'll recommend what kind of malaria prophylactic you should take, depending on the region. And the invention of this pharmaceutical expression of extract of Artemisia, which took years to develop, actually did draw on traditional ecological knowledge of the properties of wormwood. So, you know, it was actually developed by Chinese scientists, but also in Africa, people use bitter plants, which to treat malaria as well. So, you know, the parasite also responds, you know, what we taste is bitter. It also has an effect on the parasite, but a bit more dramatic, which is what we want. So, you know, even, you know, malaria treatments or aspirin, you know, every time someone takes aspirin, it's made by pharmaceutical synthesis now, but the actual discovery of the active compound in that was a sort of long chain that you can even go back in written text. So probably in oral tradition could be even more ancient, but there's a scroll that an American bought from Luxor. Someone was selling scrolls on the streets in 1815, and this American guy bought it and then had it translated. And in there, they're talking about using willow bark to treat headache. So using this waterside tree. And then a German chemist made extracts from willow, and then someone else made extracts from meadowsweet, which is another waterside plant. And then from that, they were able to stabilize the active compound, which is now in your cupboard as aspirin. So, you know, even it's, I think also a lot of what I write about is just, you know, pulling back the curtain that you're not, because it's almost popular to say how disconnected we are from nature, but we're not. We're very, very much connected, and we're ever so dependent on nature, but we are a bit blind to that dependency and connection. And that's what the problem is not that we're unconnected, but that it's concealed from us consciously and also unconsciously.
Why do you think that is, that we're consciously kind of shielded from that connection?
We think, certainly in sort of in a globalized industrial context, it's not in a company's favor to sort of explain, oh, this organic farmed salmon, the reason we can call it organic and use less chemicals to get rid of the parasite on it is because we ship in wrasse that have been wild caught down in the southwest. We ship them up to the salmon farms in Scotland, the wrasse pick the lice off the salmon. So it's organic. But those wrasse have been taken out of their wild system. They're not reproducing in nature. And when you talk about catching wild wrasse, you know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of fish taken from, like, so where I live in Dorset, someone had a lice, and this is licensed and legal trade. It's not illegal. They caught thousands and thousands of wrasse from the bay between sort of Weymouth to Swanage. And they're gone from the sea, and they breed in sort of rocky reefs, and they swim around. They're not going to breed in a salmon net. They'll eat those parasites. So, you know, in some ways, the less we know, the easier it is for companies to have our money, or, you know, sometimes the truth is unpalatable and, you know, it suits, you know, it's easier not to have to think about that when you're eating your salmon. But then the flip side is some wild caught salmon is actually reasonably sustainable, and that's switching back to traditional catch methods. So a huge part of that has been recognition of the treaties in the Pacific Northwest and indigenous groups taking back their control of the salmon harvest, and scientists looking at what's happening saying, oh, right, when you catch wild salmon out at sea, you get salmon from many, many different regions. And then when you catch salmon in a river, you're catching salmon that are returning, you know, particular groups that are returning to their ancestral river to spawn. And when you do that, because you're standing there, you can see how many salmon are coming back to the river, and you can say, there's not many of them this year. We shouldn't take so much. Or maybe we don't even take any this year. Maybe we don't catch salmon, or we only catch salmon to feed ourselves, not for export. And then when you have loads, then you can literally see and say, okay, this year, this river, this salmon population can sustain a bigger harvest. So wild salmon isn't necessarily unsustainable. Farmed salmon, I think if you've been swimming, you've ever been in a sea lock and sort of downstream or down current of a salmon farm, the water is murkier. It's not that lovely West Coast Scottish water. It's kind of murky. And when you swim over the kelp beds, there's more sort of algae coating the kelp. And that's really different from when you're out at St. Kilda. The water's just Atlantic water. There's no sewage outlets there. There's no salmon farms out at St. Kilda. You get kelp growing at like incredible depths because the water is so clear. And then when you look at the kelp beds themselves, there's more life in them. So you can, like, if you're swimming around, you can actually see these things with your own eyes.
I think demand often means that we're not used to living seasonally like that. You know, demand is demand for different plants, vegetables, fish, and living and being in touch with nature is something that we do seem quite far from. And one of the reasons that I love swimming. And as you were just talking about kind of the medicinal roots in plants, I was also wanted to ask you about COVID-19 and some of the kind of watery connections with that, which I had no idea about.
Well, sure. So, I mean, one thing about COVID-19 is that everyone's now sort of heard of PCR, so polymerase chain reaction, and that you can use that to test for presence of a virus. And that works using agarose gel. So agarose is a component of agar, which comes from seaweeds. And what happens with PCR test is the agarose is neutral in the sense where it doesn't have a positive or negative charge. So when you put an electric current through the agar and you have your amplified sample of RNA, when it's pushed by the electric current, molecules that are heavier don't travel so far up, and molecules are distributed also according to the negative or positive charge of the molecule. So that's how you get those sort of barcoding, those outputs, and that identification. So what PCR does is, instead of making a diagnosis on the basis of immune response, so how a person's body responds, you're actually detecting the presence of a virus that you can identify, because you can identify it from the PCR analysis. And that agarose, it used to come mostly from Morocco. About 82% of the world's supply of Gilenium, which is a seaweed used for laboratory grade agar, came from Morocco. And then in 2015, Morocco restricted export. And there's a couple of reasons for that. And one was they did have declining harvests. And the Gilenium from Morocco is really in big demand because the agar was such high grade agar because the water was really good there. The gelidium was being handpicked by people diving and snorkeling to get it. Whereas other suppliers of agar use gelidium from gelidium that's picked up on the beach. So the actual sort of raw material wasn't considered to be such high quality. But then it became a bit unsustainable because it was being picked from the wild, not necessarily replenished. So the beach quality gelidium was poorer quality. It was a bit more sustainable. And since then, because lots of laboratories actually panicked because suddenly agar was restricted and expensive. And you use it not just for identification by DNA analysis, you use it for things like if you've got a bacterial infection, they take a sample, put it on an agar plate, bacteria grows and you can identify it. If you're developing antibiotics, you test your pharmaceutical innovation, the molecules you're interested in, on plates of bacteria that are growing on agar. So it's actually a huge part of medicinal drug development, diagnosis and potential treatments. So there's a bit of a panic about the restriction of supply. And since then, there's been interest in finding other sources because also the natural region in which gelidium grows is shifting because of the changing ocean temperature. So we actually get some gelidium now in the southwest of Britain and Ireland sporadically. You can see it growing around here. But there's been attempts sort of looking into getting agar from Gracilaria. And I think that's been cultivated in Chile for that on the Pacific coast there. So when, yeah, COVID-19, there's a little seaweed that probably everyone has had contact with now. Or even if you never got tested, if you never got a PCR analysis for COVID-19, you've probably had antibiotics at some stage in your life. And that would have used an agar plate in the diagnostic process. So we've all benefited from this little seaweed that has goo inside it that's brilliant for a certain function in laboratories.
Wow, the more I learn about seaweeds, the more I'm just fascinated by how powerful and varied they are. So thank you for explaining that. And you mentioned there lots of different amazing places, and I know you've swam in amazing places around the world, and I want to talk to you more about some of your swimming adventures, but maybe we can go right back to the beginning. Tell me about your early time swimming. Did you swim in your childhood? When did your passion for water begin?
So I was taught to swim by my mum in the swimming pool, and then I'm half Swiss. So in the summer, we'd be in Switzerland, and where you swim in Switzerland is in the lakes and the rivers. And then I was working in London and I was swimming in a swimming pool. Then went on a campervan trip actually around the whole of England, Wales and Scotland, mostly around the coast. And we had a dog who loved to swim. So swimming in the sea or wherever became really, you know, just daily. And I think what's interesting is that now there's kind of almost a sort of backlash to saying wild swimming. Whereas 10 years ago, if you said to someone, you swim and you didn't say you wild swim, they would assume you're in a swimming pool. So there's a function actually within that wild swimming. Yes, it is just swimming and it happens to be outdoors or in wild waters. But also 10 years ago, if you just said swimming, people would assume you're in a pool under fluorescent lighting. So it's not a redundant word for describing the kind of swimming that actually a lot more people are doing now. So I think probably there's a lot of people who swam, you know, splashing rivers and things in childhood, and then as an adult, now it's wild swimming. Also, though, I think it's really important to notice that, you know, my mum taught me how to swim in a swimming pool. So I had access to a swimming pool and a mum who could swim. And I know a few years ago when I was swimming, I went to some swim fit classes in a pool, which are great actually for if you're a bit lazy, you have to, you know, someone behind you, so you have to make an effort. And I remember someone commenting about someone being there in the class and that he couldn't really swim. And, you know, he should have just learned at school. And I said to my friend, not everyone learns at school. Not every school child actually has swimming lessons now. And actually swimming pools are quite expensive, I think, relatively. For it's not just a £2 thing or £1. It's if you were going to take a family swimming, I'm not sure if you get change from £20. So I think lots of people's pathways to swimming are different. And for some people, it's easier than others.
Yeah, definitely. And I was really surprised to learn last year how few people have access, firstly, to swimming, but also how many adults we have in the UK that don't know how to swim. And I feel very lucky to have learned. My dad can't swim. And so when we were children, my parents were very enthusiastic that we would learn and have those lessons, which I feel lucky to now. And actually have kind of, I think, because I'm so interested in swimming, I've had a few friends that don't know how to swim that have recently taken classes as an adult. But it's been really interesting hearing about their journey into that, because I think a lot of people feel it's embarrassing to, can feel embarrassing sometimes to learn to do something new as an adult. And I'm the same. If I don't know how to do something, I'm not very good at putting myself out there. And so I'm always incredibly proud of my friends. And one of them who's been having lessons, we then went to the beach and she got in and felt so much more confident. And it was so amazing. I thought that was such a huge, huge achievement, especially because I think she'd been learning in a pool. And then when you finally get to enjoy the sea and feel a bit more confident, the reward really, really is there.
Yeah, it's there, but it's also earned, very much earned and well-deserved.
So tell me about your adventure swimming all the way between Asia and Europe. That just, I can't even imagine that. Tell me about swimming. So you're more of a competitive swimmer than a dipper or an endurance swimmer, would you say?
No. So the Asia to Europe swim is in Istanbul, and it's because Istanbul straddles the two continents. So there's a swim in the Bosphorus, and you know, I think now getting a place is even more difficult. At the time, because it's limited number of places and it's limited by nationality. So I actually got a place under my Swiss nationality, because there's less Swiss people than British people, less Swiss people applying for that swim, loads of British people. So I got a place, and my Turkish friend, he was also going to apply because there's a separate application thing. And then he emailed me and he'd missed the deadline. So then I had a place in this swim that's 6 kilometers in this deep water, where I happen to know that the great white sharks go up there because they go up to the Black Sea to have their babies, is the belief a marine scientist who works in Turkey said, because when he goes to the markets and looks at the catch of the fishermen there, they're hearing about like these baby sharks that are coming down from the Black Sea. So the white sharks go up there. No one's been attacked by a shark in the Bosphorus, just so you know. So obviously I had huge paranoia because I was going to be in this big river, which is like a kilometer wide in some places, on a 6 kilometer swim, which is further than I'd ever swum, by myself, because my friend missed the deadline. So I was annoyed with him about that, but I thought, oh, I don't want to drop out. So then I felt quite nervous. And I think a couple of weeks before, I swam from my local beach to the pier and back, which is about 4 kilometers, with some friends. So then I thought, oh, okay, yeah, that seems all right. But I still felt, you know, and also crowds, lots of people, and then having to jump off this boat into this big body of water. So I was quite anxious about it. And actually, it was a lovely swim. It's beautiful. You know, the water at the edges of the Bosphorus, there's a bit of sort of plastic and stuff that washes up. But the actual channel, the water is deep and clear. And I met this guy who told me that the year before, because people repeat it. He told me the year before there'd been some porpoises swimming with him. And it's a little weird because at one point, because you get in and there's about 1,800 people going in close together, but the Bosphorus is really big. So you can actually wind up by yourself, not seeing another swimmer, especially because you have to go through, you have to navigate the current a little bit. So you swim down the middle, then to the side, and then you have to be over the other side before you pass a certain point. Otherwise you get washed past and they'll catch you after the finish line and fish you out the water because you've missed the shore. So yeah, so I managed to wind up with no one around me, and then thought, oh, I'm the wrong side now. I have to quickly go to the other side, you know, panic swim a bit, catch up to the right side. But it's a great swim. But then, you know, I have friends here who've done their own significant, memorable swims. So the bay in front of Bournemouth, you can see on a good day, you can see where Old Harry Rocks is, and you can see the Needles on the Isle of Wight. And I have some friends who've hired a boat and done that swim from the Needles to the Isle of Wight. So then they're at home and then they look and they've got this iconic swim that they invented and did on their doorstep. So I think you don't necessarily have to go abroad for that, but there are certainly, I think there's a friendliness at the the big international swims, and actually it's not really that competitive. You can be competitive if you really want to. You can go for a time, you know, personal best, or try and be, you know, fastest in your age category. Or I know some people who, when they change from one age category to the next, they think, yeah, I can win in my category now, because it was harder to be fastest at the age of 55 and the 50 to 55 year olds. And now I'm in the 56 to 60s and I can be the fastest 56 year old, but I'll win that category. Some people get quite into it. And then obviously, of course, there's the whole channel swimming and now the North Channel as well. So I think people always creating challenges and competitions, but you know, you can just sort of casually swim, and every summer, you know, I'll do at least a couple of swims to the pier and back. But when the weather's nice, yeah, I'm not a masochist. When the weather's nice or the sea's nice conditions,
when you feel compelled.
Yeah. And also sometimes you have a friend say, oh, should we just carry on? And then, yeah, why not? I haven't got a meeting to rush back to, however long it takes.
Yeah, I do find, you know, as much as it can be about personal challenge and endurance, there is also always a really supportive community with swimming, and everyone's looking out for each other, which I always think is nice, because sometimes we're not always the best at knowing when it is that we might have had enough or when there is a current. So it's really good to have that, even if it's just like you say, you're swimming with a friend. But that must have been such a huge personal achievement. I can't even imagine the elation after. And I think, you know, even having talking about friends that are learning to swim or doing an amazing challenge, something that I love about swimming is how much you feel, it enables you to feel courage after, because after you've conquered anything in the water, you feel kind of unbeatable. And I like being able to have that feeling and take it with me in whatever else I'm doing in my life.
Yeah, definitely.
And what other swims have been amazing to you? You mentioned that you swim to the pier. What pier is that? Is that somewhere you can walk to from your house?
It's quite nice because you can walk to the beach and then you can see Boscombe Pier in the distance. And it's about, I think it's technically either 3.6 kilometres or 3.9, something like that, if you swim there and back. So that's a nice distance for being a bit longer. But it doesn't take up the whole day, especially not when you just walk there. And I remember one summer I'd arranged to swim there with a friend, and he bangs on my door at, I think it was 5:30 in the morning. So I opened the door and I said, I don't know why we're doing this, really, a Saturday morning, 5:30. He says, no, it'll be great when we're done. So of course we go down, swim to the pier and back, and then by 8 o'clock we're sitting having a nice big cooked breakfast. And he said, see, it's great, isn't it? We've already swum to the pier and back. And we're eating really nice breakfast and loving it because we get hungry doing that. And Saturday hasn't even really started yet. So
it's nice to have that moment in the morning where you feel like you've kind of got this secret that you've already been up and had a swim and the day started. And especially when you're cycling or walking there or you meet somebody else. I sometimes go to the Serpentine Lido in the morning and you feel like this kind of shared delight with the people around you that you're getting to enjoy the city at an early time in the morning. And of course, the added benefit of being able to justify eating whatever you want after on a Saturday.
Yeah. But then there's also sometimes, especially in the summer when the evenings are long, I've got another friend and we'll go down for just an evening swim, just to relax, sort of potter. And you can, even in Bournemouth, you can see bioluminescence in the water.
Wow.
If you're facing away from the shore. Once I had a friend with me who doesn't really swim, so they just waded in up to their knees and it was really bright. The bioluminescence was bright that night, and there wasn't, you don't want a full moon. It's actually good if there's a bit of clouds and you want to face away from the lights along the prom, but you can still see that sparkle in the water. So that's also another thing that at some point in the year, just here or up near the nature reserve or over across the bay at Sandbanks, you'll go for a swim and enjoy the bioluminescence. So it's the seasonal moments that you have, because also obviously when it snows, which doesn't happen so often down south, when it snows there's lots of messaging because everyone wants to go for a snowy swim and it's fun. I think a few years ago during the Beast from the East or one of those cold winter storms, we went down for a swim and it was lovely because when you're in the water you can look back and see the cliff top was white with snow, which hardly ever happens here. but it'd taken us about half an hour to get down to the beach because it was so icy going down the cliff path. And I actually crawled because I'm really paranoid about falling and breaking myself. So I just crawled shamelessly on my hands and knees because some of my friends were just clinging to the railings and just, you know, so to get down there, it took way longer than the actual swimming did. But then that's part of the experience and it's part of the seasonal changes when you're, which is different than if you're in a pool indoors, because you don't get that, you don't get bioluminescence in a swimming pool indoors. You don't have that weird experience of like having to battle to get to the water, then just swim for 2 minutes because it's so cold. And then, you know, it takes you 10 minutes to get dressed because you're all cold and it's windy. Whereas the swimming pool indoors experience is more standardized and insulated from the seasons.
Yeah, it's a real communion with nature swimming, which is one of the main reasons I love it. And I've been lucky enough to see that kind of sparkle in the water of bioluminescence once. I was in Cornwall along the Helford River, and the water there, I guess, is quite brackish. So it's almost got a green tint to it. And there's a creek called Frenchman's Creek, and that's where Daphne du Maurier set that book, which I always love to think about. And you have to be quite careful there because you can drift quite far. But it was a late evening and we'd wandered down, and like you say, it was really cloudy and I'd never seen anything like it in the water. It was so beautiful. And that spot is just wonderful because it's also very muddy. So if you go and the tide's a bit far out because it's an estuary, you kind of have to get your feet stuck in all the mud and you have to be careful not to cut yourself on any of the stones in there. And it can be quite funny because you're walking around getting your foot's like getting all stuck in the mud, and it's just so fun to be connected to nature in that way.
Do you think it's interesting you mentioned Daphne du Maurier when you said that area, because for me as a writer, a lot of her writing is actually very connected. She writes fiction, but it's very connected to the landscape, because the actual plot of Frenchman's Creek is driven by the location, the creek access, the way you can go from the sea up the creek, not be seen, because in that part of Cornwall, there's still forest that comes down to the shore. So you can go up these waterways covertly. And that's a huge part of the story, the way that the plot develops, the ability to go in and out. And then if you look at Jamaica Inn, you know, the terrain. And I don't want to say too much in case someone hasn't read Jamaica Inn, because I don't want to spoil the plot. But, you know, a big part of the skullduggery that's going on is actually based, again, on that seashore landscape and what it enables people to do. You know, and then if you think about Rebecca and the hydrangeas that are described in the opening scene and how they look, the colour, and that's to do with the pH of the soil they're growing in. So that's, again, that's the underlying bedrock. So for me, Daphne du Maurier's, her books are really shaped actually by the landscapes that she knew, and the plots and the descriptions really grew. It's fiction, but the landscape really fed that and nurtured, you know, these very interesting stories that she wrote.
You're so right. And I love that about her writing. And I've actually got a book somewhere up here above me called Daphne du Maurier's Hidden Cornwall, or maybe it's Forgotten Cornwall. And it's lots about the mining landscape around there. And it's the secondhand book I found in a charity shop. And it's got loads of old pictures of derelict buildings and old mining bothies along the coast and cliffs. And I just love it because you can see why she's drawn to that landscape, because there's something spooky and romantic and wonderful about it. So I didn't know that she'd been so enthusiastic about actual conservation and keeping the history of that part of the country alive. So I felt really connected to her when I found that. I'll send you a picture of it. It's very interesting.
That does sound cool. I feel like she's sometimes, you know, in the sort of canon of fiction writers, she sometimes gets less recognition than I think she actually deserves. Perhaps because Frenchman's Creek is sort of dismissed as like, oh, it's like a romance novel. But actually there's a lot going on in the landscape and how she shares a time and a place with you.
Yeah, I love that about her writing. It's very evocative. And let's chat a little bit about your writing, because you have a book called Wild Waters, which is beautifully illustrated and just captures the magic that we've been talking about swimming and water. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about it.
That genesis was really, I can't believe it was actually probably about 6 years ago, or maybe 7.5 years ago. I kept pestering the editor of Outdoor Swimmer at the time, saying, you know, when you're swimming outdoors, wildlife is really different thing from swimming in a pool. And this is like a huge different thing. It's both terrifying, but also potentially really enjoyable. So it's kind of polarizing. Like Marmite can terrify you, or you can just be like, oh, enraptured and have the best experience. So I sort of pestered him periodically about that. And then one day I thought, no, it's really worth persisting. And my friend Alice, she does illustrations. And then I told her about this. I said, maybe, how do you feel about doing a drawing? And then we can send it to him with the drawing, and then he can see what it would look like. So we did bioluminescence, and Jonathan said, oh, great, can you do this every month? I said, yes, this is totally. So Alice and I have been working together for a while, but friends for longer. Obviously, we met while swimming. And the illustrations work because you can show concepts that are quite hard to photograph. So for example, we're talking about weaverfish, which can sting you if you stand on them. To get a photograph of a weaverfish stinging someone, first you need to persuade someone to walk around repeatedly and try and capture the moment when all the sand is kicked up when they get stung. I'm not sure of the ethics of that. Yes, it can be cured with a bowl of hot water, but it is incredibly painful. And also, it's not really fair on the fish to deliberately provoke them into stinging and losing their defensive and sort of predatory device on you. So yeah, an illustration of a foot coming down towards it, that captures it so much more ethically and in a clearer way than trying to get a photo of that happening. And then there's some things, so when I wrote about grey seals, when you see them hauled out on rocks, when you see them on land, you shouldn't be that close to them, because when they're on land, they're resting, they might be digesting their food, sleeping, and they're more vulnerable. And then especially if they have pups, because even if the adult jumps into the water, people going too close to the seal, you can cause that pup to be abandoned, because at some point the mum will actually have to cut her losses and think, well, that baby's, I'll just leave it, there's no point in me staying. And because I remember talking with someone once and they said, oh, it's fine, the mum went off the rocks and she was watching us from the water. And I said, but she should have been feeding, or she should have been feeding her baby, or she should have been sleeping. She shouldn't have been in the water watching you, because you were close to her pup, that she didn't come and attack you. How could she? You're on dry land. So in that illustration, Alice just kind of gives a suggestion, because I say, you know, when they're on the rocks with the pups, you should be looking at them with binoculars, or just at that distance. So in the illustration, she just sort of shows the sort of shadowing around the sides, as if you're looking through binoculars at the seals.
That's really good to know that. Because I've read some of your writing about, you know, swimming with seals and being near them. And I've been on a boat trip to see seals. And like you say, you're very far away and you want to be close. But that's, of course, that makes total sense, because they're waiting to be washed back into the water after they've finished sleeping and digesting their foods. I'm going to Lundy Island this summer, which is an island off the coast of North Devon. And I'm so excited to see the seals there. And I guess we'll probably be paddleboarding, so I'll keep that in mind as well, to have that safe distance.
Yeah, it's different when they're on, it's different when they're on land and when they're on water. So often what happens when you're swimming is seals will come to you, and you'll see their heads up, looking, eyeballing you across the surface of the water, and you think, oh, that's kind of cool, they're checking us out. And then they disappear, so you carry on swimming. And then as you're swimming along, looking down, there's a seal underneath you on its back, sculling underneath, just casually checking you out from below, and like sort of zipping past and then looping back. And so the difference is that they're coming to you, and seals are playful and they are curious. And if you're swimming, just going along, you can swim along and they can choose to come close to you. Or if they're not interested or they're busy with other stuff, they won't. But they're not threatened by you in the water, because when you see a seal swimming, you realize how crap you are at swimming. Seals are amazing. It's just so casual. Like, they're swanning along on their backs, high speed, just no discernible flapping. It's just how they move their body. So you'll feel like you were just really like a, it's almost like you're a toddler wearing a life vest, splashing the water and not really going anywhere when you compare yourself to seals. So that's a good experience to sort of learn, oh, they're all big and on land, they're quite ungainly, but in the water, their buoyancy control, their movement is beautiful and efficient and elegant. So they'll swim around like that. There is a difference with, you often see pictures of divers with seals, and seals can be quite sort of puppy dog like. So they'll come and they'll mouth like the hands of the diver. But you've got to remember that divers are wearing different gear than you. So flippers and gloves, neoprene gloves. And actually, if you get bitten by a seal, you can get quite bad infections. And so seals that come a bit too close, or actually start to touch and interact with you, as a swimmer, you would probably want to step back from that, because divers are a bit more cushioned by what they're wearing. And there have been a few reports of people being nipped by a seal that's tagging along and maybe been given food by people, or just a bit over familiar with people. So there's different kinds of experiences with seals. And yeah, I think on paddle boards, you might see the seals coming underneath. If the water's nice and clear, you might see the seals coming underneath, looking up at you from below, as well as looking at you across the water from a distance.
Oh, I'm so excited.
With all the animals, it's being aware of how you are in their space, and if you're forcing them to acknowledge your presence, or if they're able to go on about their business, or if they're able to leave and go away and it's their choice to be near you, or if you've cornered them, or if, you know, there's like loads of you snorkeling all at once and actually you're all around a seal and its favorite haul out or its pup. So it's spatial awareness, behavioral awareness, where you think, what does the animal want or should it be doing? And some animals will give you real clues as well. So seahorses, you're not supposed to go out looking for seahorses. You need a license to photograph them. But swimmers do sometimes see seahorses when you're going over seagrass meadows, because they like to hold on to the grass with their tail. It's handy. And if they're disturbed by your presence, they'll put their head down and they'll look away. So whereas if they're upright and swimming around, they're not that bothered. So they're actually telling you, oh yeah, I'll just carry on with my thing, or oh, I'm trying to hide, there's something observing me. And same with birds along the shoreline. You'll get, if birds are flying up and calling out as you come closer, you probably disturb their nests. They've got nests or eggs there, and they're hovering, trying to distract you, and they're not able to go back to the nest, but they should be on the nest. So it's really, again, it's that thing of we are a bit detached from nature. But then it's just sort of like maybe a language you start to get to know, especially your local patch, how things behave when you're there, and understanding a bit what animals are telling you, because they are telling you, they're responding to you, and you can, you know, it's like when you have pets and you actually get to know what they, you know, they actually train you to understand their signals for time for tummy rub, time for snack, or we should go for a walk. You learn their behavior. So wild animals, you can start to understand what they would, how they would prefer you were. So throughout the book, it's very much, here's how some wildlife will tell you you've taken their space. Here's how you can enjoy it. This is, you know, in sensitive times. So trout streams, trout lay their eggs in shingle, a little bit gravel in the riverbed. So between about November and February, if you go wading in trout streams, you'll disturb the eggs, and they're very sensitive to disturbance. So you'll probably stop a lot of them from hatching. So you could swim in a trout stream from November to February, but don't stand and stomp along in the gravel on the bottom where it's shallow. Maybe stick to the deeper river pools. So the whole book is very much about making informed choices, as well as where you can see things, which, you know, a lot of conservation, you know, the conservation model has developed differently here than in the States. But there is the idea of sort of fortress conservation, where you protect nature by keeping people out. Whereas I think actually, especially, you know, this year with the Dartmoor restriction on overnight camping, a lot more people are getting a lot more vocal about how the more space people have access to, you know, the less damaging the footfall. But also people can be really good custodians, and they'll They are actually vigilant and get to know places, and they'll report violations of environmental regulations and things. So people aren't necessarily harmful. So while you're thinking of, do people have a right to have access to outdoor open spaces? Should you only be able to get that right by being incredibly wealthy? And actually what does happen, and I think a couple of times I've been to the Wildlife Crimes Conference, which is mostly the police and a lot of people from the RSPB, you know, and a lot of the wildlife crimes units, they're very minimally funded, and a lot of police put in a lot of hours in their, you know, free time. And actually really, you can't have police everywhere. So a lot of wildlife crime actually relies on people who are out and about in the countryside, seeing something that's not right, ringing and making a report. Not necessarily trying to take on people then and there, but ringing the police, making a report, you know, saying, oh, this change has happened, or, you know, local example is the River Tess. There were some swimmers going in, I think it was a couple of years ago, and they were seeing a sheen on the water. So they thought there was diesel or something, oil in the river. And they reported it, and they reported it several times before it was taken seriously. And then in a boatyard further upstream, there had been a diesel leak. So no one in the boatyard had either noticed or reported it. But people who are in the water said, no, this isn't right. It doesn't usually look like this. Something is wrong. And of course, diesel in a river is really damaging.
And you're so right that we can do this when we begin to notice the nature around, you know, our patch and what's normal and see those changes. And I think for any listeners, a great place to start is with your book, Wild Waters, and to get excited about learning that we are lucky to share. It's not our space, it's their space when it comes to nature and wildlife and animals, and learning how to feel both appreciative that we get to share it and how to respect it is hugely important.
Yes, definitely. I do think, you know, I'm in favor of people interacting with nature because it's much more tangible when rather than an abstract concept. And when you have skin in the game, when that's your wildlife and your thing that you enjoy, you'll defend it much better than when you think, well, I don't. And perhaps actually that's the thing about the right to roam and stuff is, imagine how powerful it is if instead of all the private land in sort of the 2% hands, what if 98% of the population says, hey, you know, you may own the land, but the water runs across the landscape and the wildlife, you know, we see it in the skies, and it's not constrained by boundaries, and we have access to this, and we're going to hold you accountable when we see your land management not following regulations. Or how much more powerful it is when people start saying, hey, I know this is how it's farmed and it feeds me, or, you know, but when I go in the river, there's all this nitrogen runoff and then the river's green. And so how can the farming practice change so that the runoff isn't quite so toxic to this other habitat? And I think perhaps that's an interesting thing that might change, is the more people who feel they have, who understand that they do have a stake in outdoor spaces, even if you're in a city. And of course, there's some really cool wildlife you can see in cities, like Birmingham otters, you know, great place for otter watching. Who would have known? Well, the canals are cleaner than they used to be. So it's not that you can't see wildlife in cities. It's an urban environment, but wildlife is there as well.
It's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for joining me, Susan.
Thank you.
So that was Susan. I hope you enjoyed our chat. Now, don't forget that you can pre-order my book, The Tidal Year, wherever you buy your books. I'm just 3 weeks away from publication and it really helps. You can also meet me at events in London and further afield, so check out my website for more information. There's a few Q&As, some book readings, and even a wild swim. Thanks again to this episode's sponsor, TryHard. Say goodbye to chloride and shop their skin and hair products at 15% off with the code TIDAL. See you at the next episode.